Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun 2-day conference style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello and welcome to the International Schools Podcast. I'm Dan Taylor. I'm recording the podcast here from my office in Prague. It's a sweltering 35 degrees. It's going to get up to 37 today, which to some of you isn't very much, but here it's quite a lot. And there's a rugby game I'm involved in organizing tonight, so it's going to be pretty crazy. But I'm delighted to be talking to someone from Hong Kong, Tim Evans. I've known Tim for a while. He's presented at a few events I've been at. He's an EdTech coordinator of an international school in Hong Kong. So welcome, Tim.
Hi, Dan. How are you? Thank you very much.
Yeah, good. What's the weather like in Hong Kong right now? It's probably humid, I imagine.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. About the same temperature as you guys, but you know yourself over here, it's humid. So we're just getting to the hottest time of year, so July and August. Where the humidity is pretty much unbearable.
Yeah, it is. Well, we'll get into Hong Kong in a minute. I actually love Hong Kong. It's one of my favorite countries and cities, I guess. Both, it's kind of both and together in the world. First of all, Tim, I want to get a bit into your background. It's always good to learn about something. So, let's start from university. Did you get straight into education at university?
No, so basically born and raised in South Wales, so I went to Swansea University. I looked at European business, and part of my degree was there were ICT modules, or there's certain modules you could choose, and I was always electing the ICT strands, basically, and that's when I started looking more into the ICT side of things.
What does ICT stand for, just in case someone doesn't know?
Information, communication, and technology.
Right.
So I was looking at those modules. So my mum was a primary teacher, so we'd always been in and around education, both obviously in school, but then outside of school as well. So it was always something that interested me. And then I went down the ICT teaching route then. Starting off in Wales, I taught for three years in Wales.
Right. Was that at a regular, like, secondary school?
Yeah, so actually it was a school I went to as a student. So I went straight back to the school I was... I attended for 7-8 years.
Right.
So I went there and I was an actual ICT teacher, what I call a traditional ICT teacher. So when you're going back 15, 20 years ago, when it was ICT in the sense that they were teaching you how to use Microsoft Word, desktop publishing, and databases, spreadsheets. So that was pretty much the limit of it.
And we're going to get into that a bit later on, talking about the changing role of ICT. Mm-hmm. That's one of the topics I want to discuss with you. Yeah. Oh.
So from Wales, then I moved over to Spain, and that was when I first started at the international schools. So well,
what was the reason you made the jump to international schools? Did you just feel like traveling abroad, or did you want to try something a different education system?
Yeah, I was keen to try abroad, and Spain was the obvious option because my family always had a holiday home there.
Yeah.
So it was almost like a bit of a safety net as well. I knew the country, knew a bit of the language. So Spain was the obvious option, and an opportunity came up then. And I felt I needed to get out of, not so much Wales, but I had to get out of the same school I'd been in all my life. So I felt I needed to experience something different, see something different. So it all tied in.
Great. And where was the international school in Spain you worked in?
So it was a school called Lauda Newton College, which is Alicante, which is on the east coast.
Yeah.
Great part of the world. So I was there for 6 years.
And what was your role there? Were you ICT teacher? Because I think you've transitioned more into being like an EdTech coordinator now. Where did that transition happen?
That happened as I was leaving Spain, basically.
Okay, so Spain, you were as a teacher.
Yeah, so we were NYP IB school there. So I was more on the digital design side of things, but then we had to cover the Spanish curriculum, which was very traditional in ICT content, and then we just tied it into the NYP framework itself. And then as I was leaving, there was this kind of shift into the idea of technology being integrated into different subjects. So I did that for a year, as well as teaching that. Then I decided, my wife's Spanish, I met my wife there, and we thought of making a move then. And then an EdTech coordinator role came up here in Hong Kong, and that was something we jumped at.
So in terms of Spain, because I've heard people say the salaries are not as good in Spain as in often in major.
No,
business.
It's not.
Is that the case?
Yeah, that is definitely the case. But it's one of those. It's such a great place to live. Quality of life there does help a great deal. But it's just, I feel like when you're at a certain stage in your career, which I was then, and I am still in a sense. At the beginning of my career in education, you do feel that it's a little bit too comfortable in the sense that you could find a school there and you could be there for 30 years.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people like that who just stay in Spain because it's just pretty chilled.
They do then. So I just felt I wanted to challenge myself, learn a bit more, see a bit more of the world. And my wife was on the same mindset, so we looked to make a move.
And did you get hired as a teaching couple? Like you both got hired at the same school?
Well, we didn't. My wife's actually a Spanish teacher, so she didn't actually get a position at the very beginning because there wasn't the need for too many Spanish teachers, as you can imagine, in Hong Kong. But within 2 or 3 months, a role came up then. There was a demand for more Spanish. So she actually was teaching in the same school as myself then. So it was
okay.
A couple of months she wasn't, but she is now.
Fantastic. So let's talk a bit about Hong Kong before we get into your role and talking about IC. So whereabouts, you're in Kowloon, aren't you, in Hong Kong, which is the
yes,
mainland
yep,
kind of peninsula part of Hong Kong?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. A school called Stanford American School. A new school, we're only open to so we just completed our second academic year, and brand new school, and opened in Kowloon.
Yeah, I need to come and have a look. When I'm across in October, we should come and check it out. I've never been there yet.
Definite.
Now, What's it like? Let's get into a bit of what it's like to live in Hong Kong. There's obviously people looking at it as a place to live and work as a teacher or other roles. I guess the first thing is that the cost of living is quite high. You get paid more, but it is an expensive city to live in.
It is. I mean, the rent is one
yeah.
of the most
tell me
what
like what's
a,
tell everyone like what's a typical rent in Kowloon for you've got a 2-bedroom flat.
So you'd be looking at in euros. You'd be looking at between 15,000 and 30,000. Hong Kong dollars, sorry. So in euros, then it's 1,500 to 3,000 euros a month.
Yeah.
But it's funny with Hong Kong because some things are really cheap. So if you do want to go out and eat some places, you can find some really cheap places. Places are almost cheaper than Europe. So
yeah.
it's your rent, your accommodation is by far the most expensive thing. Everything else you can get by as you would in a European country.
Yeah, the public transport is pretty good as well, isn't it? The metro I've taken quite a few times and it's really efficient.
Everything's so connected. So I've actually got some family coming out, and being that again rent's so expensive, we haven't got any spare bedrooms here. So they were asking me where's the best place to be located hotel-wise, and I said anywhere really, because it's so well connected. You're within 500 meters of an MTR, pretty much anywhere along Hong Kong Island and up through the middle of Kowloon. So wherever basically, and even the buses. Once you get the confidence to try the buses, and they have these little green minibuses that bomb around. Once you get on them as well, it's even more connected.
Definitely. And what how do you find what's in terms of a social life there? Do you find is it like a lot of kind of is there like an international school educator kind of scene, or do people kind of hang out? Is it one of these cities where people kind of hang out with people from their own school quite a lot?
We started off like that, obviously, when we all came over. But then you grow your social groups in any international scene, basically. It's very expat Hong Kong in the way that a lot of the locals keep themselves to themselves, and they have different social habits, basically, than what maybe the Westerns would.
So is it a bit less integrated in that sense? It's more that expats tend to hang out together more?
It is definitely like that, yeah. I you mentioned rugby earlier, so I play rugby over here, so I joined a rugby club, and all of a sudden then you just got a massive social group there. You know yourself, you just join a club and you've got a load of guys there. Great thing then is they've normally got girlfriends and wives, so then you can connect with your partners and what have you. And we socialise a lot with them.
Yeah, that's one thing I was talking about. I mean, Declan from Swiss German School and Jacques and all these guys I know in Hong Kong. It seems like the thing I like about Hong Kong is, I guess it's a bit like here in Prague, but a lot of us, socializing is all around sport. A lot of people play sport, and there's just teams of every level, kind of whatever you play, you know. It seems pretty good for that.
It's a common interest as well, isn't it? I mean, there's loads of guys in our club who never, and I'm sure you've seen them before, they never put boots on and they never play and everything, but they're the heart and soul of the club.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the rugby's an excuse. They say rugby spoils a good social event, yeah, the game itself.
Yeah, and the other thing is about Hong Kong, which I find interesting, is you've got a lot of these very, I guess it originated in the British colonial times, but you have a lot of these sort of, they're social and sports clubs like Hong Kong Football Club, Hong Kong Cricket Club, which a lot of people join. Have you got involved in any of those, any of that kind of thing?
So we looked at Hong Kong Football Club, but just because location, we're based in Kowloon, so I actually joined up with Kowloon Rugby Club themselves. But you go onto the island, yeah, you're right then, they've got all, it's very traditional British then. You go to Hong Kong Football Club, it looks like you go in, you can see when it was built and how it was, it's very much influenced by the British.
Yeah.
And the cricket club's the same and everything.
Yeah, but and they tend to have, what's interesting about those things, they have every kind, I know they have like, they have football teams, rugby teams, squash, tennis, like biking, everything, you know?
I mean, it's called Hong Kong Football Club, but I think I had to guess, must have 10, 20 different sports.
Yeah, yeah. We went there with Declan last time, and it was a really good, it was just like, it was cool. They got a bar restaurant right by the main pitch. It was like a really nice place, yeah. You know? I think it's expensive to join, I guess.
It is, yeah. I mean, they've got we've got kids in school at 6, 7, and I see them in their soccer jerseys or something. So it's a big family thing there as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's a huge family thing. So what else, I mean, in terms of like, what do you do in Hong Kong on a weekend? Do people just tend to, I mean, I guess obviously it changes now. You're like me, you've got a young family now, so things change. But there's especially for people who are single, there's a huge social life there, like, which is really, really cool. It's like very active.
It is. It's a busy city. And one of the things that actually drew us to Hong Kong, mind you, was its actual location. Because it's got like one of the biggest airports, busiest airports in Asia. So you're connected everywhere. So I mean, sometimes we have a long weekend, we'll pop down to the Philippines, you can pop to Bangkok, Taiwan, yeah. Vietnam's a couple hours away. So that's one of the main reasons we chose Hong Kong over other cities.
I've noticed that in Hong Kong. People, they think not, it's just a standard thing. Oh, it's a weekend, we'll go to Bangkok, we'll go, yeah. It's like a regular thing in Hong Kong, isn't it?
Well, we're a couple of hours, not even a couple of hours from Hanoi. So we pop to Hanoi and like we joke, like, if you have a good busy weekend in Hong Kong, you'll spend the same amount of money in Hanoi, including a flight and hotel.
Yeah. Well, that's like living in England and you take EasyJet to somewhere in Eastern Europe or whatever, you know, like
exactly that. Yeah, and they have the low cost airlines here as well, just like you would have your EasyJet, your Ryanair. And
yeah, I like, you know, the part of Hong Kong I like to go out is the mid levels. I haven't been there for a couple of years, but I really like so many good bars and restaurants up there. It's kind of, you know, people don't know there's this crazy escalator which goes, like, a lot of people they work on Central, which is down the bottom, and they live in the mid levels, which is the hill. And there's this huge, I'm just I, obviously, you know, Tim, so for anyone who hasn't been there, this huge escalator, it comes all the way down in the morning and then everyone commutes down on it. And it changes direction and goes up in the evening and everyone goes back. And it gets, and kind of the rent's more expensive depending on how far from the escalator you are, because it stops at every street. It's a really crazy thing to see.
It's quite comic when I first heard that. So I thought, so it's basically like everybody's coming down off the hill to basically central area to work. And then, like you said, then it cuts to a certain, I'm not too sure, I think it's 5 p.m. or something, they switch it.
Yeah.
So it goes back up then. But again, it's all really connected. They do really think, because it's quite a modern city in the way that a lot of things have been developed recently. They do think of people, and because of the heat and the humidity and everything, that's why I think everything's so well connected.
You know, a funny thing about Hong Kong is I've been to Hong Kong a lot. I mean, the first time I went there was when I was a student, but it was still British, actually. But I've been a lot. You know, most countries in Asia, if you're a foreigner, you know, European foreigner, you kind of, people will notice you a bit. You might, you know, like some people will even stare at you. Like, I've never had one person in Hong Kong even acknowledge me or even look like. There's just so many foreigners there that you're not even like, people wouldn't even register that you were a foreigner. You know?
And I think it's because of the history as well. There's always been British people here for X amount of years. So I think they're that generation, the generations now are used to it and everything. But it's a real cosmopolitan city, as in you could easily go out and have a Western night out, Western food, etc. Or you can really go, you can go to TST and there's almost places you'd call Little India. So you've got your little Chinese, Indian restaurant, sorry. So there's all that. That's again, which we love about Hong Kong, is that if you want a steak and fries, you can have a steak and chips. Or if you do want some dim sum, or you want a curry, you want a pizza, you basically you get everything here.
I think like a lot of Asian cities, the one thing you've got to be happy with is just crowds. You've got to be happy with you're on the sidewalk and there's just 1,000 people. You know, if that's going to bother you.
I'm from West Wales and we're in a village of like 500 people where we live in an urbanization, a block of flats here where 40,000 people live.
Really? 40,000 people block?
There's 26 towers. It's one like building with one name.
What's the name? I'm going to look at it on Google Maps as we talk.
It's Laguna Verde. So it's in a place called Whampoa. It's got 26 towers and there's 40,000 people living here.
Wow.
I can't even get my head around that, even living here. And it's funny, in the mornings you go down, we have two school buses going from just here.
I'm just looking at it. It's huge. And it's right by the water as well, which is cool.
Right, yeah, no, it's really nice. Like you mentioned, we've got this family now, so it's ideal. The promenade, we can walk all the way along the Victoria Harbour.
So, first time I went to Hong Kong was 1993. And so where you look out there is the old Kai Tak Airport, which was amazing. So now it's a piece of land with a cruise terminal. But that was, I still remember it really clearly. Like when you used to fly into Kai Tak, you'd come in and it was one of the hardest approaches for pilots. You had to fly with an experienced pilot to do the approach. And you'd fly towards this mountain with this sort of red and white pole over top. And literally at the last second, they take a 90 degree turn and then head straight down. And then as you flew down, it's just like everyone said, like you were literally looking at people putting out their washing in the window and stuff. You were like, right, you could see them clear as day. It was the craziest thing in the world. And everyone had told me about it, but it wasn't until I experienced it. But it was just it's a shame people can't experience that nowadays, because it was something else landing there.
Well, back then, they said there's only a certain amount of pilots who'd actually do the route. I mean, some pilots, they just refused to do it, said, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
But going back to where we're living now, I reckon in 93, maybe a little bit earlier, that we would have been in the sea. So this is part of reclaimed land that they've, especially along the south of Kowloon. There's a lot of land there that they're reclaiming. And I think where we are now was part of the actual Victoria Harbour.
Would you say, like, if you were recommending areas to live in, would you say any areas better than the other, or would you just say live close to where you work?
I mean, when you count the hours, you're either in work or you're in bed.
Yeah.
So I think get close to where you actually work. We've got a few teachers joining us in the summer. What we do, we have a buddy system where we pair up with a teacher for a couple of months beforehand. So I've been talking to a guy who's actually coming over from Central America. And he said he's got a couple of kids. I've actually recommended where we live. So we've been really happy here. We can be in work in literally 10 minutes. And at the same time, the connection then with the MTR, which is our metro, you can get to Central, you can get up north to new territories. I think for me personally, it's always close to work.
Now you mentioned work hours. I mean, Hong Kong, there is a work ethic in Hong Kong. Does that sort of seep over to education? Do you think people work long hours compared to other countries there?
It does. I think the actual general public here, I mean, they put high demand on education, as in, and the Chinese local schools have less holidays than British local schools, but let alone the international schools. So I mean, we've been on holiday now for 10 days, but you walk around, there's little kids in uniforms and things. So they really want kids to be educated.
A lot of kids do. A lot of local kids do Saturday school there, don't they? And they do tutoring in the evening and things like that.
Oh, we have kids. They say, I've got to go home now. I've a math tutor, and then I got piano lessons. So they do put a lot of pressure on their kids. A lot of them are one kid families as well. So there's even more pressure on the individual then. So it goes then. So it's a longer school day, but it's the same everywhere then in Hong Kong. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a lot like that all over Asia.
What's the school day? So tell me a typical school day like for you. Like, so you're an ed tech coordinator. That's your role there, isn't it? So you're also teaching, aren't you?
Yeah. So my schedule would be, if you looked at my schedule, it'd be the easiest teaching schedule in the world, because it's pretty much blank. But what it is then I'm almost, we're trying to go with the idea that I'm a resource as well. So teachers can book me out to come into a class. They can either book me out to teach a topic, support them teaching a topic or support the students.
Right.
So I'm booked like a resource in the same way then that they can book the VR headsets, they can book Apple Pencils, they can book things like that then.
Yeah.
And then in between then is I will find teams who are off schedule, they're not teaching, they've got planning time, and I will go in with them then. With the goal is to upskill the teachers. So yeah. I want teachers to be able to use, I mentioned the VR headsets, I want them to be able to use them. It might start with me going in, and sometimes if I'm teaching the kids, I'll ask the teachers to be there so I'm actually teaching them at the same time, especially when it comes to like the tech skills.
Yeah.
So that's the actual system we're trying to work on, and we're in our second year now.
What would you just before we get into the role model, what would your school day be like? What time would you arrive and what time would you leave typically?
So I get to school about 7 a.m. Students arrive at about 7:30 for a 7:45 start. And then what they will do, they'll finish at about 2:30, but then we have after school clubs. I lead a few after school clubs because of the tech side of things.
Yeah.
So I'll be home then about 5 p.m. then.
Okay. So in terms of your role at tech, did you make a conscious decision like to leave teaching and get into more of a sort of tech role, tech coach type role? Was that something you wanted to do?
Not really. It was because we were looking for actual roles, and I saw this role was advertised in a lot of places. So I could actually see, oh, this is actually something that's becoming more and more popular. There's been a demand for this. So I looked more into what the role could be, and I just like the flexibility of the role. I obviously still want to stay with the kids, so I do want the teaching side of things. I mean, I just love any interaction with the kids during the school day is great. So I still want that side of things. And also in my role, I want to actually see how the kids themselves are reacting to a certain technology where maybe a teacher's opinion isn't what image of what's actually going on. So, and again, I want time with the teachers, so I get to work with everyone. And what we actually do as well, we do a lot of things with parents as well, so we do a lot of digital citizenship things with parents, and we even got the idea of upskilling parents as well, so if their kids got
I don't know if you listened to the interview, John Mixon and me, we talked a lot about digital citizenship a couple of weeks ago, and we got into like doing stuff with parents as well.
It's massive, digital citizenship now, I think it needs to be looked at even more than it is, especially Hong Kong. I mean, we're in a part of the world where everyone's literally on their phone 24/7.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the thing in Asia is a lot of people have one device. I mean, I remember like going to, like, you know, now you get the large size Android and iPhones. But I remember even before they existed, you used to go to Asia and people would have a huge, like almost tablet sized phone, like long before you ever saw them in Europe, you know, because that was their one device. You know, they just did everything on there. And that was much more common, I think.
I came over here, and when I was sorting out my phone contract, they said to me, we got an 8 gig deal or a 10 gig deal. I was like, wow, I'm not going to get through that. Yeah. But then I see why now, because a lot of them are streaming, they're watching Netflix, they're watching YouTube as they're walking through the street and everything. So they get through a load of data. And yeah. To get through data, there's obviously device time as well.
Yeah, definitely. So one thing you wanted to talk about, which is interesting, is how like at your school you've moved away from ICT classes into more integrated skills acquisition and teachers leading and stuff. So should we talk a bit about like the evolution of the ICT teacher? Like what broad topics did it involve? You know, because it's kind of interesting how we talked before the podcast about how typically that didn't include any programming, which I always thought was a bit strange, you know. But let's talk about like what that role was traditionally and how you think it's changing and what you're doing.
So traditionally, I mean, I was in school, it was first term would do Microsoft Word, second term would be desktop publishing, and third term would be a database or something in Microsoft Access Excel. Yeah, that's it then. Yeah, and that's what it was. And I think the idea was that we were upskilling students, ready for university, ready for the job world, but back then was becoming technology orientated, as in they even had to write letters, CVs. I mean, we write in Microsoft Word, we write a letter to a job application or something.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden now, everyone's got access to technology. It's just evolved.
And there's so many other subject areas that didn't exist. I mean, obviously just like robotics and stuff, for example, maker spaces, things like that, which is just a whole new area which wasn't there, you know.
It's massive when you hear so many people talk about education hasn't evolved in 50 years. Well, that side of things has evolved in 5 years. And it's a big challenge for schools because, when you look at a teaching career, it could be 30 years or longer. So you've got individuals there now who might not have the actual skills or the confidence to actually teach an actual topic. But what we're doing with technology now is if we wouldn't look to teach a student how to use Keynote in a Keynote lesson, we would maybe try and integrate it into another subject. So if they're studying geography or something and they're looking at planets, well, how can they present their knowledge? How can they present a concept or something? Could be through a keynote. So what we'll do is we'll try and get the teacher upskilled on keynote. If not, I will come in and support them. But that's where they will learn to use a PowerPoint or a presentation tool.
And what broad sort of areas of technology do you work with? Obviously, you know, you've got your desktop software for Apple, like whatever areas. I presume you've got Google and some other stuff.
Yeah, so we're actually one-to-one Apple devices. So we're elementary schools, primary school is one-to-one iPad, and then middle and secondary school is MacBook Air. We're actually looking at our year 7, grade 6 next year, actually going to iPad Pro with Pencil, smart keyboard. We're just testing that for a year.
Yeah.
To see how that goes. But then within those devices, then like you said, we use the Google G Suite is a great. And then we have got the iWorks as well and everything. But they're just support tools. We're just we don't want them to be seen as, and I think it's our generation do look at it, oh, that's a piece of technology, but the students don't. They just see it as a tool for learning.
Yeah.
That the younger generation. I mean, a 7-year-old doesn't think, oh, we've got an iPad in class. That's amazing.
Sure.
They just think, nothing.
Whatever technology do you work with? Obviously, Apple stuff, Google stuff, Apple software, Google stuff. Whatever things. I know I've seen you do stuff with drones and things. Is that something you work with?
Yeah. So we basically, I mean, just quickly, just talk on the actual Apple and Google stuff.
Yeah.
What we're really, really trying to do is less apps, but apps that have most outcomes. So we want them to be students to be creating. So that's where you've got your keynote, your Google Slides. I'm trying to upskill myself with Google Sheets and the things you can do with that now. So it's just something that can be integrated into another subject, just to support the learning.
Yeah, because these are all tools you can create with. I mean, the problem with the world of apps is kids can get sucked into being consumers of content as opposed to creators of content very easily, you know, and you've got to try to break that cycle a little bit.
Yeah, completely. So we've got to give them, to put a ecosystem in where they can actually actually do that. So we're trying to upskill them so they've got the skills to do that. But I mean, I'm a big fan of creativity. I mean, we see students, it sparks their curiosity. They're actually thinking outside the box. I mean, it builds their confidence. And then these are skills then that they put into other areas of the school then.
Yep. Yeah, cool. So that's interesting. Whatever areas would your stuff, is it mainly revolving around Google and the Apple tools? Is that?
Yeah, they're the two. I mean, I've looked at Adobe things, but then I've just taken my professional opinion was I don't want to overload teachers more than anything. I don't want them to. I love Adobe Spark, but I say, look, at the moment, let's concentrate on the Apple and the Google ecosystems. Let's get everything we can out of them first. And as we go into middle school, high school, we can introduce students to other tools, and then they can make the decision then on what's the best tool to use.
It's interesting because you're part of Cognito, which is a huge group of schools. Like, do they mandate that, or can schools choose themselves? Like, what software?
No, completely flexible.
Right.
I mean, you go to the British schools are more Microsoft, because I think the British government had a big push on Microsoft things in the last 10 years, so they're more Microsoft. Less Apple, whereas you come to Asia, most schools are Apple or Google. I mean, I don't know many schools that are on Apple, on Microsoft.
Sure. You know, now I'm seeing it so much of a hybrid approach anyway. People are using, you know, they'll use a Mac, but they'll use, you know, Microsoft Suite, and they'll use G Suite as well, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I love Apple both personally. I mean, I'm a bit of an Apple fanboy, but I come from the MYP background as well, where as a teacher, we were always told, don't tell the students what tool to use when it comes to creating an outcome. We have to make sure they've made a conscientious decision that this is the best tool for that.
Definitely.
So that's really helped me in my role now.
Yeah. I think a general thing, I agree with that completely. I'm recording this on my iMac with 2 27-inch screens. You know, I'm an Apple guy as well. Although Google's my main thing, you know. But for me, the switch, I'm using less and less Apple tools, because I'm just moving everything to web-based tools. Just, I mean, partly because I got so into the Google ecosystem, and then there's so many good web tools now, which are like, I mean, okay, like, you know, if you need Photoshop or you need Final Cut, then you need desktop software. But for most of what I do, I can get by with a web tool, you know.
So what I like about Apple is the actual hardware. It's so easy to use. It looks so good. It's so comfortable. But then you can see now, like, even Google G Suite now, with each update, a lot of it is aimed at an Apple device. So we can comfortably use G Suite on an iPad. You wouldn't even know. We've just rolled out in the last 6 months Apple Schoolwork, which is basically Apple's Google Classroom. And Apple have I get the impression, they left Google do everything on their own for a couple of years with Google Classroom, Google Drive and everything. And then they've decided, right, there's definite a market here. And they've come in now in the last couple of years with their tools. Everything's Apple at the moment is towards education.
Yeah.
Keynote just today put a new update out, and it's definitely aimed at education. They've had global events everyone create, which is definitely aimed at education again.
The one thing we mentioned again at the beginning is about, for me, I always found it a bit strange that, like, teaching coding wasn't part of the ICT teacher thing. Like, what, especially, I mean, maybe it is becoming more now because you've got tools like Blockly from Google and a bunch of very simple kind of, you know, UI based tools to teach coding. Like, have you ever been involved in teaching coding, and do you think that's changing in your kind of role?
It's definitely changing. My background, I've got no coding background at all. It was all stuff that's been self-taught. There's nothing that I've actually done officially during my time in school or in university. But I just think it's just evolved so much because there's tools now out there. I love Scratch. Scratch is amazing.
Yeah, Scratch is great.
You got your Tinker, your Hopscotch, and then you go into your robotic side of things with your Blockly, with your Dash and Dot, your Lego, even Minecraft, things like that now, Microbit, all these things now block coding, which is basically the introduction. So I mentioned Microbit. Now Microbit, you can toggle between block coding, or if you just click a button, you can actually see the language code. I think it's Java, I think they use. So you can actually see, again, the students, and it's great for differentiation. So you have an 8-year-old who's flying through block-based. You can easily just pull them to one side and say, right, let's have a look at the coding language. Curiosity then will hopefully get them learning that then. So almost as an educator, I think the mindset's changing, and it's a bigger challenge than you think. But I've spoke to teachers who don't feel comfortable using a tool. I don't expect them to be comfortable. I mean, I mentioned I haven't done any coding. So yeah. I say to a teacher, that's fine. I mean, we've got a big ethos of learn the tool with the student. There's a new tool come out. Right, let's sit down with the students and let's learn this.
And a great way to put it to teachers is, like, just what you said, like, a lot of these tools, they have a great interface where you'll kind of drag and drop and link kind of literally blocks of things together like a jigsaw to make. And it's a really good way to understand at a high level what the program is doing, you know. And then, like you say, you know, you can toggle and look at, you know, there might be JavaScript or Python or PHP or something behind it. And the teacher probably worries, well, I don't understand Python, so what? Like, but they should think, they don't need to. They can understand how to put it together. And then the kids that are really advanced at programming say, look, hey, by the way, here's the code. Look at it. You can edit the code, you know, and you can get into that, you know. But I think, you know, the teachers, they don't have to know that. But you know, because they're not going to be able to help the most advanced students, but at least they'll be able to get most of the class going on it.
Exactly that. I mean, especially when you go into primary school and lower parts of secondary school. I mean, we don't expect teachers teaching a year 4 students to be masters of Python. Far from it, do you know what I mean? But they've got to have that mindset of we're willing to explore that. We want students to take risks. So I think as teachers, we need to be role models now. And we need to say, look, and I've said it before to kids, look, we've just got these VR headsets. Just had literally a couple of hours playing around with them, but I think it'll be fun if we explore them together. So the first 20 minutes, we're just going to explore them. And the kids do it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm learning stuff off students all the time. And I acknowledge that then. I mean, I think you don't want to hide behind that. I mean, I thank them, do you know what I mean? And they're part of the learning process. And it makes it fun as well. I love that idea of exploring and the actual kids themselves come up with an idea.
Definitely, definitely. Cool. So just to, I guess, to finish off, I mean, you've done a few certifications. I think the main one, Apple Distinguished Educator. How did you find that program? It's something I've looked at doing, and like everything, just been too busy to get around to applying. Like, do you recommend it? It's kind of a strange one in that, like, can you explain how it works, how the whole selection process works and everything?
Yeah, sure. So it's basically you need to put together a 2-minute video highlighting, showcasing how you use technology. Obviously, there's a push towards Apple being in, obviously. But then, I mean, I mentioned stuff that I do on Google in my video. But you need to highlight in 2 minutes and put it together, edit it, all singing, all dancing. And when I first did it, I struggled to think, 2 minutes is actually a long time when you actually count count it down into sections, yeah, what have you. But it's the opposite then. You actually, one, the actual 2 minutes, but you have 2 minutes of quality, so you're actually cutting things out. So you send that off. So this academic year, you send that off in January, and they let you know about April. So they do it every couple of years.
Yeah.
It's a tough one because, I mean, we had 5 or 6 teachers in our school apply who, for me, they're amazing teachers, absolutely amazing, the stuff they do in the classroom. And then I almost felt a bit of guilt. Do you mean that I got awarded it? But a lot of it was, it's a team effort. Do you mean it's a complete, I mean, I come up with some ideas that we can, but it's without the students and without the teachers actually.
But they don't get the certification.
I mean, they don't get the certification. That's it. And I did feel a bit guilty.
Is it like the Google Innovator? Like, if you keep applying, people generally get accepted eventually, you know? Is that how it works?
Very much so. I think it is more like the Google Innovator. So we're quite proud in our school now. Every teacher is an Apple teacher qualified. So because we're on iPad, it was. I don't want to use the term non-negotiable because it comes over a bit negative, but we want a teacher saying, look, we're using these devices now, so we believe that to get the both best up devices, we need to have these certificates. Next academic year, we're looking at the Google Level 1. Google Level 1 for me, if I had to recommend one for a person to do, it would be Google Level 1.
Yeah, Google Certified Educator Level 1. Just a quick plug, Apps Events run boot camps all over the world, and we can come to your school to do it if you need help. So get in touch.
Done, brilliant. No, it's a great one. I mean, and it is a challenge. I mean, I put my hand up. I failed it the first time I did it.
Yeah.
And it's my role. Do you mean? And basically, it was one of them that you had.
But it's not expensive to take again. That's a good thing about it.
No, how much was it now, Jay? Down was it 12?
I think it's $10 now.
$10, yeah. I said James then because I was talking. James, yeah. James with us in Asia has been great. So he's been running all the apps events here with us. So I need to speak to him actually.
Yeah, definitely. It's great. I mean, the Apple teachers are pretty simple one as well. I know Microsoft have got one as well. I think, you know, I always tell teachers, look, you should be doing this just for your own resume, just to have these things, you know, because it's something that's easy to do and it jumps out on your resume or CV when a school looks at, oh, you know, you've got all these.
It just shows you've got that growth mindset, that you're willing to do things. I mean, I've heard people actually talk down about these certificates and what's the actual point of doing them. I think it just shows as an individual, you're willing to push boundaries, you're willing to challenge yourself. I mean, I did the ADE, now the Apple one, and it hasn't made any difference to what I'm actually doing in the classroom.
Yeah.
But what it does do, and I think a lot of these do, is the community side of things. And all of a sudden, then you can connect with people, you're on the same page. And that's what I've just noticed. I mean, they had the Google Innovators in Sydney a couple of months ago, and I wasn't involved in it, but I was just following it on Twitter because you could just see what everybody was sharing.
It's interesting. You know, I've done a bunch of certifications over the years, but the only one that has really changed the course of my career was doing the Google Certified Trainer, you know, which you've got the Educator 1 and 2, and then you can do the whole trainer program. And I did that. I was the first trainer in mainland Europe. I did it 2011, 10, I don't remember. But that was what led me to start Apps Events and start working with schools, you know, and start training, you know. I'm like, wow, these tools are amazing, you know, and that's what got me started.
If I can ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
So what, so you do Google Level 1 and Google Level 2, and then you apply to do that, and what is the course, and what do you actually have to do?
Well, yeah, you have to do Educator Level 1 and 2, and then you record a video, and you take an online test, basically. Take an online.
And that's completely different to the Innovator, is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's separate from the Innovator. The Innovator is you know, you attend a three-day event, 2 to 3 day event. And really, the Innovator, you know, very similar to Apple Distinguished Educator. You record a video. If you're accepted and you do an application, then you go and you attend this event, and it's very much like Apps Events. We're involved with some trainers and helping out with the Innovator Academies. You know, very much like using all the Google tools together, using a lot of different stuff, and then you have a project. You know, you make a project afterwards. Certified Trainer is very much focused on training Google tools in schools. You know, training teachers, training students. So it's interesting, you know. If you want to train, I mean, either in your role or to do as a, you know, as a side job, as a side income, become a Google Certified Trainer. Like, it changed my life, basically. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have met you, and I wouldn't have met a ton of other people if I hadn't have done it.
That's definitely. I mean, I just mentioned there that I asked teachers to do Apple Teacher. I mean, in my role, to be honest, I need to be looking at doing that just so I can actually do some qualification stuff with our actual teachers as well. And then, like you said, then if there's opportunity to do something outside of my role here, then that's great. But no, I think I need to be looking at doing that one.
The thing about it is, to keep certified, you record all your trainings, and you need to do, I think it's like 12 a year, 12 trainings a year, which can be small, you know. I mean, you can do, I mean, if you present four sessions at a summit, that can count as four, you know. So it's not difficult.
Yeah.
And it's actually good, because there's been a few, you know, there's ebbs and flows of work, and there's times when I wouldn't have done that much training, but I've kept it going because of this. So I Google Certified Trainer, I couldn't recommend it highly enough. You know, it's really helped me. If you're into Google tools, obviously that's the key prerequisite.
Right, well, I have to do level two first. So
yeah, level two.
So put it on my list.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you. Where can people find you online?
So Twitter is my go-to. So @EdTechEvans. I find those who aren't on Twitter, highly recommend it. They talk about certifications. I think it's the best PD you can get. I mean, I'm getting ideas daily off people.
I go backwards and forwards on Twitter. I'm fairly active on Twitter. And then you can get good stuff on it, but it's signal to noise. There's a lot of crap on there as well. That's a problem with it, you know.
Yeah, I think you got to narrow down who you follow, the hashtags you follow. Yeah. There's a lot of noise.
Like, I've got a lot of strict rules. Like, if someone posts anything about politics, I just unfollow them. I get it. You all hate Trump, you know, but I don't want to just see that every day. I want to learn stuff. So I just, and I know it's really bad, because there's a lot of people who I like who post politics all day, and I like them as friends, but I just don't follow them on Twitter, because I don't want to see their posts, you know.
I mean, mine is completely professional, I don't see any politic tweets at all, really. And like you said, if same as you, if I saw something, I'd be like, unfollow. But it's just so many ideas, and I'm really encouraging our teachers here now to get on there as well, because you get little ideas that you can use in your classroom tomorrow. And I've mentioned this and to James as well, that's where the apps events were great, is because you do a Saturday and a Sunday, and then you can take tips back to school on a Monday. And for me, that's the most valuable PD. It's something, little takeaways. I love the demo slams you do.
Yeah, that's what I've focused everything we've done as a company as well on just what you said, stuff that you can use on Monday, you know. Like, there's a lot of educational conferences, you know, getting into high-minded concepts, which are great. You know, there's obviously a place for that, but it's not what we do. We just do, like, here's what you're going to use in the class the next day, you know.
And then I just quickly mentioned your demo slams there. For those who don't know, is basically you've got 30 seconds, a minute to actually give a quick tip to people at the end of a weekend. Well, I find Twitter's almost like a demo slam. It's basically each tweet. If you fine pick what you're following in your hashtag, each tweet is a mini demo slam, basically. And it's mobile. Do you mean, so I'll be sat in a taxi or sat on the MTR, just scroll through. Like, I'm big on screenshots. I'll see something, I might not go to it there and then, but I'll screenshot it.
You know what I've noticed people getting, who've been getting really successful, a lot of followers on Twitter, is making just small videos of just demoing something, and just, I just spotted this, here's how to do something in Google Slides, bang, quick video. Like, you can get shared a lot by doing that.
Yeah, and a lot of times, I mean, it's such a simple thing, and you think, I didn't even know you could do that. And it's not, you don't have to have it, anybody can use it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can I made a point,
I'm going to start recording more of his videos, because I'm always like, I should share that, you know, and I'm going to start doing it.
Well, you've seen Seti down in Bangkok.
Yeah, Seti, who records, people check out Apps Events video channel, he does every 2 weeks now. We moved it from every month to every 2 weeks, so he does some great videos.
He's brilliant. Just, again, small things. It's not complicated at all, so anybody in teaching can integrate that into some part of their schedule. And some of the tips are about for us as teachers, we're better organized and all that kind of idea. We can start to use calendars a bit better, Google Gmail, Google Drive, things like that.
Yeah. Anyway, Tim, great to talk to you, and let's meet later in the year in Hong Kong.
Yep, perfect. Thanks a lot. Cheers, Dan.